This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories that they've been covering on their award-winning website this week. And roll up, get your tickets for Spreadsheet Phil and the White Van Scam. How did a boring budget get, well, so messy?
60% of self-employed people will pay less national insurance. But for those on higher incomes, we've asked them to pay a little more national insurance contribution.
A raid on small businesses, entrepreneurs, the self-employed, from a Conservative government no less, that in their manifesto pledged no increases in national insurance, income tax or VAT. Surely not. Well, the move hasn't gone down too well with their own MPs, and now the proposal's been put on ice until the autumn.
The change to national insurance will require legislation of its own. It won't be part of the finance bill. Always what happens with national insurance changes.
Also in the budget, the tax-free dividend allowance came under attack.
This will hit private investors with large portfolios, even if it's primarily aimed at self-employed people who set themselves up as a company.
Simon looks under the bonnet of a market-leading savings deal announced on Wednesday as well. Is it as good as it sounds? If white van men have been hit, what news for white vans themselves? More woes on the horizon for diesel drivers. Were there actually any winners from the budget? Plus, to try to save you a bob or two, This Is Money have compiled a guide to help you avoid rip-off cover, keeping your insurance bills down. We also asked just how worried are you about having a comfortable retirement? What do you need to do?
About putting in the minimum amount required by law, so is their employer. And that's a fantastic start, but it will only build them a small pension pot.
We also look at proposed hikes to council tax, just how much extra will you need to fork out. And if you've actually got any money left after all of that, perhaps you fancy a meal out with your partner. But if one of you earns more than the other, who should pick up the bill? Well, This Is Money's been exploring just that very thing and how to navigate bringing up other awkward money issues with our loved ones. But I want to know, a very good morning, Simon, a very good morning, Lee. In that circumstance, who should pay?
Good morning. Well, I think we need to put our fingers on exactly what the circumstance is here. Is it a circumstance where you're just out to dinner with someone who you know, who earns a lot more money than you? Maybe, so for example, a friend or member of family? Or is it if you're specifically out with your partner? You know, which one are we going for?
I'd say someone really pretty close. So like
really
a best friend
close.
Or
so
a partner
best friend
or family,
or family.
Member.
Yeah. I think best friend or family, then you should work on the basis that you're going to split the bill. But if you're the higher earning, and you know you're the much higher earning friend or member of family, then it's nice every so often to offer to pick it up. But you do that out of, you know, your generosity, not because you're expected to. I don't think that anybody should ever expect someone to do that. Mm. I think if it's your partner, it's a slightly different scenario. So working on the basis that you're going to be going out for dinner on regular occasion with them, I think that then becomes a bit about how you work out your family finances. I think, again, it's great if the lower earning person picks up the bill every so often, because you don't want to be the lower earning person who never picks up the bill. But I think that the higher earning person should probably pick it up more. So I've given an example of the fact that my wife works 3 days a week. She's self-employed, so she's one of these terrible tax dodgers that Philip Hammond was talking about. She earns less money than me. You know, because she works less time. There used to be a time when she earned more money than me. But I probably end up paying for dinner more. I do end up paying for stuff more often than she does. But it doesn't mean that she doesn't ever pay for stuff. And then to give another example, a very, you know, old friend of mine, you know, he's done really well for himself. He earns a lot more money than most of the rest of our friends. And every so often, if you're out to dinner with him and it's just like you and him or something, he'll offer to pick up the tab, but I would never, ever expect him to pick up the tab.
Lee, for you?
Always got to split the bill, Georgie. Always.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. And partner and I, we usually take it in turns. And it's usually whoever organises it, right? So if I said, oh, you know, I want to take you out for dinner tonight, we're going to go to this fancy restaurant, I think the onus is on me to pay. I'm not going to turn around to my partner and go, oh no, we're going harsh on this, by the way. And
that I agree with.
Vice versa. So she'll book somewhere and I kind of, you know, think she's going to pay. I always offer, but I know she's going to pay. It's kind of just how it works as it rolls around. And there are some close friends where I think, well, I probably will chip in an extra 20 quid or whatever. You know, you just kind of know. I think it's like, if you're just a sensible person, it's in your psyche. But last weekend, I've got a good story about this. I went for a brunch in Suffolk. Just went on a little day trip up there. Yeah, I'm embracing my middle age, pending middle age. And there was four older people. I'd say, you know, maybe in their 60s, 70s, two couples. The guy, I'm not joking, he got his calculator out and he worked out how much the bill was individually, not even per couple. And I remember him saying distinctly, Marjorie, your tea and your bacon sandwich has come to £8.70. And they were honestly getting out there.
Money. So maybe married couple.
It might be a bit of an era thing. Yeah, it was. I'm going to presume both couples were married. Maybe they were just four friends. I don't know. But he got a calculator out, not even a calculator on the phone, a physical calculator out of his blazer pocket.
Simon, what do you think of that?
Reminds me of a story that many years ago, we were on a family holiday. I think we were in America. We were sat in a restaurant with my parents when I was younger. And there was a family nearby us, the couple that were clearly the parents, and then the kids who were probably early 20s. When they got the bill, the dad insisted that the bill was split evenly between like him and all the kids, went round the kids basically getting them to all pay their bit. And we could overhear this conversation where one of the kids was saying, well, I don't have enough money to pay it. And the dad was really coming down on them hard and saying, well, you've got to pay your share of the bill. My dad was just sitting there with his head in his hands going, oh my word, what is going on here? And the poor waitress who was having to deal with this, I tell you, she earned her tip that night. Well, she probably didn't get a tip.
I was going to say, probably not. Did they calculate that as well? Well, it was International Women's Week, so surely it's the men that always pay, no?
Well, so there you go. I'll flip this around. There is definitely still this difference that goes on between the whole men and women paying for the bill dynamic, and there's still kind of sometimes this thing where the man's like, I should pick up the bill because I'm the man. What do you think about that if it means that someone else pays for your dinner?
I'm going to say nothing.
On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio.
A very good morning. I'm Georgie Frost. Here with me are the team from This Is Money for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS9. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to take a look at some of the stories that they've been covering this week. And this was the week the Chancellor delivered his first and last spring budget. Boring, lacklustre, even in Simon's words, refreshingly dull. But you'd never believe it with the row that's blown up. Now, beforehand, we did have a lot of noise, didn't we, about planned changes to business rates. Yes, there was a hint that there may be a raid on the self-employed and small businesses, but surely not from a Conservative government whose actual 2015 manifesto pledge was no increase in VAT, national insurance or income tax.
60% of self-employed people will pay less national insurance as a result of this change. But for those on higher incomes, we've asked them to pay a little more national insurance contribution to represent a fair contribution to the pensions that they are now able to receive on the same basis as employed people. That's worth £1,800 a year to a self-employed person, and to the National Health Service. All self-employed people use our National Health Service just in the same way as people who are in work having their tax and national insurance deducted each week from their pay by their employer do. And it's only right and fair that we should take this small step to closing the gap between the treatment of employed and self-employed people. And I think people across the country will recognise that there is a basic unfairness when two people earning the same amount of money, accessing the same state benefits, are paying very different contributions for the benefits that they receive.
So the rise in national insurance for self-employed from 9 to 11% is about fairness, says the Chancellor. But is it fair? What about the high risk of self-employment, the absence of sick pay, pension contributions, holiday entitlement and minimum wage contributions? Well, Andy Chamberlain is from the Association of Independent Professionals and the Self-Employed. He's not impressed.
It feels as if at a time where he doesn't seem to be raising national insurance anywhere else, indeed it was in the Conservative Party manifesto not to raise national insurance, he's gone after this part of national insurance. And we just feel that he's putting at risk the great value that the flexible labour market brings to the economy by sort of going back to this group and looking at them to find more taxation, when in fact these people are working very, very hard. They're the engine of the economy. And we feel that a Conservative government should perhaps be supporting these people and helping them get into business and encouraging them.
Well, it turns out many Tory MPs agree. The legislation has been delayed following pressure from some Conservative MPs until the autumn. No such move for the tax-free dividend allowance. That also came under attack. Here's Share Radio senior analyst Ed Bauscher.
This move will hit private investors with large portfolios that are not within ISAs or pensions, especially if they've invested a lot of the portfolio into high-yielding income stocks, and they will be concerned, even if it's primarily aimed at self-employed people who set themselves up as a company. These private investors will be hit as well.
So apart from that, we got a bit of relief for a lot of pubs, not great for drinkers, smokers, fuel duty frozen, more money for schools and social care. We got a bit of news about the state of the nation's finances. We even got a few, dare I say it, not too bad gags. But Simon, at the end of the day, was the joke on the self-employed entrepreneurs and small businesses. But before we get to the nitty-gritty, because you have been specifically writing about this, an overall view of the speech, if you would. How did he do?
Well, it was the comment at the end of it from one of my colleagues was, well, there's an hour of my life I'll never get back. So, despite Mr. Hammond's penchant for chucking in a few gags, it was pretty dull. Mm-hmm. Not a lot happened, apart from the baffling kamikaze move in the middle of it, which we will get onto in a minute.
We will indeed.
So, yeah, but we were looking for a steady hand on the tiller. We were looking for a dull budget. He's only just given us the autumn statement, in which he said he wasn't going to make the autumn statement a budget, but then announced quite a lot of stuff that would normally be a budget. He's going to can this budget anyway. Mm. The reason for doing so was because he said any changes that do come in the March budget, you don't have time to allow for them before the end of the tax year. So he's going to shift the budget to the autumn. So it would have been slightly hypocritical to then bring in a load of changes, having said that. So I don't think there was any expectation that it would be anything other than dull. Unfortunately, probably because it was so dull, is why he didn't get away with the baffling kamikaze move in the middle of the budget, which in a George Osborne budget would have just been like fallen into the pit of all the other things being announced. I mean, Osborne would have probably masked it with a small business helped a small business ISA or something.
Very true. Lee, we also got a little bit of news about the state of the nation's finances leading up to Article 50 being triggered and Brexit. Where are we at?
There's a bit of revised figures. There always are in these budgets. And there was that great tweet that went around actually from the OBR about its forward forecast. Someone called it the flamethrower graph because it's got the predictions of GDP, and then either side of it, it goes up. There's about a 10% swing either way of where it could go, which I think is absolutely brilliant. So they just don't know. Basically, it could be going anywhere. But going back to the actual speech itself, I ahead of the budget thought, I even think I mentioned this on the show last week, that I thought it might be the shortest ever budget, 45 minutes. It wasn't quite, but it wasn't far off. And actually, I looked at last year's budget document and it was 148 pages, a real thick, you know, document. Mm-hmm. This year it was 68 pages. And as Simon rightly says, if this was a George Osborne budget, he would have had something that was headline grabbing that would have deflected the attention away from this, you know, whole self-employed fiasco that's come. Because it would have just been like the headline grabbing, let's say. But it's very telling that Philip Hammond on every single newspaper, even pro-conservative newspapers, were pretty damning about him. And the picture of him on the front page of the Daily Mail today was actually a little bit terrifying. He looked a bit like the Joker. I was quite scared of him.
And it's still continuing days afterwards as well. Some people have suggested the gags was just to pad it out, and it probably would have been about 45 minutes
late. Yeah, could have stripped the gags out. I mean, I think he's looking to become a comedian or like some sort of panto like star in the coming years. And those gags, I mean.
But the joke, Simon, as I said, on the self-employed, perhaps. Why are we talking about this? You're talking about this camera. Kamikaze move, the one that's got everyone going on Nick shambles. It's been called the row about Class 4 national insurance contributions. What is the problem? Surely, Simon, it's about fairness, as the Chancellor said, and they're going after those that are abusing the system as well. And a lot of people do, don't they?
Yeah. Mm. But so, I mean, Mr. Hammond promoted this as about fairness. But I must admit, as he started talking about it, I thought to myself, I really thought he wouldn't do this. It had been trailed ahead of the budget, but I really thought that he wouldn't do this, because why on earth would you stage a tax raid on the self-employed and small businesses? It was spectacularly dumb. I thought that they had people around them employed to say, no, no, don't do this. But this was a classic, you know, shoot yourself in the foot move. This had 10p tax rate written all over it, which was the famous Gordon Brown one. It's interesting for a number of reasons. Like, firstly, it's a real change in rhetoric. OK, so everything we've heard over the past, you know, almost a decade has been, yes, small businesses, you're the lifeblood of our economy. You know, we want to support you. We know life's tough for you and we're going to help you. We love the entrepreneurs. You're the people who make this country great. You're going to help us out of the recession. We know things are difficult, so we're going to help you out. And all of a sudden we flipped over to, hang on a minute, look at these tax dodging small businesses taking more than they should and not paying for it. Yeah, we're going to come down on you. I mean, that's not actually what he said, obviously, but that's the message that we'll be taking away from this. And it's a really weird change in message, especially now when I was under the impression that we were meant to be helping these people to deal with the uncertainty of Brexit. I think the second interesting thing here is how it was sort of couched in this language of fairness and the changing face of employment. Now, I don't think that the changing face of employment that I think is being alluded to here, people driving an Uber or riding bikes for Deliveroo, I'm pretty sure that none of those people are doing it because they're shaving a few percent off the tax bill. I think a lot of people are doing those jobs because they can't actually get another job anywhere else. And in fact, there's tribunal cases going through at the moment where people who work for Uber and work for Deliveroo are fighting to say that they are employees, that they're not self-employed because they want the rights of those people. And then, you know, Hammond said this thing about the national insurance and the fact that this is outdated, that people pay less. Now, it might be that originally people paid less national insurance because of you didn't get the same state pension benefits. And now you do get the same state pension benefits. But he completely missed the point here, OK, because the world has changed. Maybe we need to look at it from a different perspective, which is from the modern world, and say, well, yes, they do now get the same pension, but look at all those other things they don't get that we've legislated that people have to get now. People have to have a pension. So your employer has to pay into a pension for you under auto-enrolment. That is the law. People have to have holiday pay. That is the law. People have to have sick pay. That is the law. Now, these are all things that if you're self-employed, you don't get. You are the person who has to pick up the tab for all those things. So, yes, you could give them to yourself, but you're the person who has to pick up the tab for your pension. You're the person who has to pick up the tab for your holiday. You're the person who has to pick up the tab for your sick pay. You're the person who has to pick up the tab for your maternity pay. So, actually, maybe on the basis that we were going to be helping these people out because life is a bit harder for them and they are the lifeblood of the economy and all that other stuff, they should pay a little bit less national insurance. And also, I think the national insurance thing, it's really interesting because politicians love national insurance because it's kind of palatable to like put it up a little bit because people don't think of it so much as a tax. But this is akin to sticking 2p on income tax, on basic rate income tax. And you can imagine the uproar that would have occurred if he'd done that. So that's just the national insurance. As for the dividend stuff, I think it's just targeted at the wrong people. It's basically collateral damage at savers and small businesses.
What is the dividend one, remind us?
Well, basically, there's this situation where there's a way to effectively dodge some tax if you set yourself up as a limited company and you then get your money in. So you earn, you get paid, for example, by a company, and contractors do this a lot, especially IT contractors. They get paid by a company as a limited company, and then they basically pay themselves a minimal amount of money as a wage in order to keep their tax and income tax and national insurance bill down. Then they pay themselves the rest in dividends, which is taxed at a lower rate. And there's also this tax-free allowance. Okay, but the tax-free allowance of £5,000 was only brought in last April because the tax on dividends was hiked to try and deal with this. And the reason why that allowance was brought in was as a trade-off for hiking the dividend rates for the people who genuinely are small entrepreneurs and benefiting from it and don't know where their next pay packet's going to come from, not like a contractor who knows exactly who's going to pay them next month, and also private investors. So that was a trade-off. So what's happened now is we've kept the higher tax rates for dividends and we've slashed the trade-off down from £5,000 to £2,000. And what's really baffling is that these things aren't really going to actually raise that much money. In the grand scheme of things, you know, relatively speaking, it's not going to pull in that much money. But it has sent out a very, very strange message at a time when I thought we were meant to be playing it straight and dull and boring.
Lee, to you, the move has been put on ice, can we call it that? They're not going to bring it in now.
Yeah, well, it's had such a backlash, even, you know, Tory MPs have...
The National Insurance one, I should mention.
Yeah, there, I mean, you know, it's been such a backlash to it. Tory MPs are, you know, saying this can't really happen. You know, it's really targeting people that are sort of, you know, some of which are core sort of Conservative supporters and voters. And, you know, I'm going to be... This could be... do you remember the pasty tax? This
yes,
could be pasty,
indeed.
Pasty tax 2.0, where he has to have a U-turn on this. And I, you know, as someone says, it was meant to be a really dull budget, and he's known as spreadsheet Phil. I mean, could he now be known as U-turn Phil for this? I wouldn't be surprised. And he was even cracking jokes in the budget about a former chancellor doing a budget and then being in a job for a few months afterwards and saying, oh, I hope I'm going to be... Well, I tell you what, that joke might come back and bite him somewhere nasty after this. I wouldn't be surprised if next week there's some sort of complete U-turn. Where are the advisors in this? Why aren't advisors sitting around going, do you know what? I don't think this is going to be a good
idea.
Didn't
he say, look, it's only going to hit the wealthiest, those that earn the most? And actually, look, the reality is we need some money for the NHS. We need money for social care. And, oh, that can go. That's on.
But that's not true. So he basically made this statement in the budget. And this is my other problem with this. Okay, it was kind of a little bit of false figures going on here. He talked about this huge gap in the national insurance between a worker earning £32,000 and a self-employed person earning £32,000. And then he put up this national insurance as if that was going to cover the huge gap. But most of that huge gap comes not from the worker's national insurance, it comes from the employer's national insurance, okay? Because your employer pays 13.8%. So it is an issue for the government that there's more people self-employed because they are losing out on that national insurance. But this thing where he says, oh, it's going to affect the higher paid more. Well, once you earn above £43,000, you only pay 2% national insurance, right? So the higher paid, yes, the 2% more will be more of a chunk. Mm. But actually, I think it doesn't. I think it hits the people who are earning the £20,000, the £25,000. I don't think it hits the people earning big money. And I tell you who it certainly doesn't hit in terms of the dividend crackdown. It certainly doesn't hit the highly paid company directors and IT contractors who are earning, you know, £100,000 a year and funneling it through their companies in order to save on tax, because they will find other ways of clawing it back. And in fact, I tell you what, a lot of the IT contractors, if they suddenly find they're making less money because there's been a slight tax crackdown, will turn around to the companies employing them and say, you just need to give us more money. And you know what? This is rife in the public sector as well. But instead of actually just cracking down on that practice, which is what we're meant to be doing, in fact, we've tried to do it before, we've just taken aim at something that actually hits the person who is running their own business, who brings in £20,000 a year more instead. And then also, I mean, they had a manifesto pledge not to raise national insurance, didn't they? We've talked about this on the show before, about David Cameron's completely bananas pledge not to raise national insurance, income tax or VAT throughout the parliament. And then he said he was going to pass a law on it. I mean, and so then they turn around and they raise national insurance. And people say to them, well, hang on a minute. Didn't you make a manifesto pledge not to raise national insurance? Didn't you pass a law about that? And the Treasury sources go, oh, yeah, but when we said that, we didn't mean that bit of national insurance. We meant the other bit of national insurance. And that's in the legislation. You'll see that's in the legislation. So then someone turned around to them and said, yeah, but well, you know, when that election was held and people voted for you, you hadn't put the legislation out yet. And your manifesto says we commit to no increases in VAT, national insurance contributions or income tax. And there wasn't any small print in your manifesto that said, oh, apart from the self-employed, because we're going to get them. So it's just erupted into this almighty row, which brings me straight back to the question in my mind of why on earth would you stage a tax raid on the self-employed and small businesses? How stupid is that?
Right, well, Simon has a breather there, Lee. Also announced on Wednesday, we got a confirmation, didn't we, of a bond,
yes.
A 2.2% NS&I bond.
Yes.
Market leading. You're not quite so enamoured, though.
No, that's right. So he announced his bond in the autumn statement, and he said at the time it was going to be 2.2%, and he said it was going to be over a three-year bond. So he confirmed it, and he said it's for hard-pressed savers. So the biggest problem with it, the problem with it, is the fact that you can only put up to £3,000 in it. Now, they're saying the reason for that is that allows half of the population to be able to open one of these accounts and max it out. So in all intents and purposes, it means everyone in the country really could probably open one of these accounts. There was a bit of a fiasco. Do you remember with the pensioner bonds? It's very similar to that. Pensioner bonds were for over 65s, January 2015, but that was 4% over 3 years. And it was also a much higher £10,000 that could pour into those accounts. So it was a much better product. It was much meatier for people to be able to actually get a return from that. And I think he's had a look at that and he thinks he's a bit of a winner. Mm-hmm. And he's going to hope to replicate success with a market-leading bond. Now, problem B with it is that it's not a market-leading bond. There's currently a savings account that offers 2.2% over 3 years. Okay, it's a little bit more complicated. It's offered by Atom Bank and you have to run it via the app and it's not the easiest thing. And, you know, some people do just want real simple, this is how you open it, it's done. You can manage it online, on the phone and post. And that's what this account will be. It'll be a very simple product. But problem C with it is actually in the very same budget in which the OBR gave its inflation predictions, its revised inflation predictions, it says that inflation will rise to 2.4%. In 2017, it raised to 2.3% next year, and it will fall back to 2% in 2019. So this account, you're going to lose money on it. It's not inflation beating if it sticks with OBR predictions. So, look, our readers are not impressed with this account. It offers £67 of interest a year if you put the maximum amount of money in it. It's not really going to help hard-pressed savers.
What needs to get done, Lee? Is there anything on the horizon? Any green shoots?
What should have been done with this product, really, is that they probably should have spoken to some savings experts and people who are actually close to the ground and know how these things work and gone, do you know what? When we announced this in the autumn statement, we said it was going to be 2.2%. Let's nudge it up a little bit. Let's find somewhere somehow we can just nudge it up ever so slightly. The thing is, at the moment, the government could borrow money very cheaply. You know, and that's the thing. It's going to cost them money to offer this product, right, to people. Mm-hmm. And people will open it in their droves. They know people will open it. People are desperate for a return, a safety net, a really easy account to open and manage. But this is where George Osborne would have been that headline-grabbing chancellor, where he would have gone, right, no, you know, we said it was going to be 2.2% in November. It's going to be 2.7%. People would have loved it. I'm telling you, even at 0.5 percentage point jump up, people would have loved it.
Lee, isn't the reality, though, while I'm sure individual MPs really would love us to save more, to be more frugal, the reality is for the economy as it is, it's not good for us to save.
It's very true, George, it is, but at the end of the day, there's lots of people that have money and they don't know where it's what to do with it, you know, and they might be tempted in opening up riskier products, you know, might end up getting defrauded from doing that. At the end of the day, the NS&I should be there for people to have a really sort of steady product and people to save into. They've come out a couple of years ago with this pensioner bond, and now people are expecting when these special NS&I bonds come out that they're going to be a little bit meatier and a little bit juicier. If he's making a song and dance about it, not only mentioning it in the autumn statement, but in the budget too. So why offer such a lacklustre product? You may as well not bother at all.
I love winding you guys up. This is brilliant, because I'm going to continue. We had the white van scam, didn't we? But what about the white vans themselves? Diesel cars. They weren't actually mentioned in this budget. There was a warning, though, wasn't there, Simon, that the government would explore the appropriate tax treatment for them. What's he got on the cards for diesel?
There was an ominous warning in the budget, that was. Basically, so this is really interesting because, I mean, we just keep kicking this can down the road. There's an awful lot of pressure being brought at the moment from sort of environmental campaigners, and rarely a day goes by without a story emerging about our dirty air. Now, there's claims about the health, you know, hazards that this causes. What I'd like to see, personally, and I'm not denying that this is a health hazard, by the way, what I would like to see is it very clearly laid out to people exactly what the problem is, exactly how they think all of these illnesses or deaths are linked to the diesel pollution, and exactly how bad it is, and whether it's got worse or not. Because if you read the stories, you'd think that all of a sudden, you know, London has gone back to the days of pea supers and smog. Has the air quality really got that much worse, or is it just a lot more stories about it? But diesel cars are blamed for this. And so we expect the government to do something. But instead, what's happening is stuff is being done piecemeal around the place by councils, or, you know, cities. So, for example, London is going to bring in a new charge for older diesels, driving into the congestion charge. Some councils charge more money on people's parking permits, for example, for a diesel car. Islington Council, my council, does that. Even though diesel cars, funnily enough, don't actually pollute when they're parked. But we won't talk about that. I had to get that dig in. But so we were expecting something was going to come up in the budget, OK? Mm-hmm. We thought, right, he's going to have to tackle this one now. Because we thought we were going to have to tackle it in the autumn statement. And we thought we were going to have to tackle it last summer. And instead, the can was kicked slightly further down the road with this ominous statement that appropriate tax treatments would be explored before the autumn budget. And, I mean, we wondered what to do about this because he didn't say anything about it. You know, it's like, what do we do, really? And I said to Rob, our motion reporter, I said, well, the thing is, loads of our readers are going to be coming in here because, like, 50% new, nearly 50% new cars that are sold are diesels. Loads of our readers are going to be coming in here wanting to know what's going on with diesel cars. So we need to write a story saying he hasn't done anything, but there is this ominous warning, so that's what's happening. But the real problem here is that, unlike carbon dioxide emissions, which every car manufacturer has to produce figures for all cars that they produce, there are no figures produced for nitrogen oxide by the car makers. It's very difficult to find out how much of this bad stuff your car is pumping into the air. The figures are there because tests are done. I mean, they might be fudged in labs, but tests are done. But there are no figures out there for cars. So as a car buyer, realistically, you don't really have any proper choice, as in, oh, I can choose this one because it genuinely is cleaner than that one. Mm-hmm. So all the car makers make loads of claims about how their cars are cleaner now. But there's a study that came out this week. I think it was a Mini it showed, was producing basically more, like multiple amounts more nitrogen, you know, oxide pollution into the air than a heavy goods vehicle.
Wow.
So, you know, something has to be done about it, but something has to be done about it in a way that is fair, because you've got to remember that basically the successive governments and the tax system have spent, you know, years encouraging people to buy diesel cars.
All right, Lee, just a quick one to round up. Anything else of note in there?
Oh, Georgie, God, it was so exciting. I can't think of anything to mention off the top of my head. There was this relief for pubs. 90% of pubs are going to be paying less on business rates, allegedly, if they're allowed to.
They might breach EU state aid rules. Whoops.
So who knows? I don't think it's going to make beers any cheaper, so it's probably not really worth mentioning too much. I think fags are going up. Have gone up 30p a pack again.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of gone sort of under the radar a little bit. Fuel duty was frozen.
Yep.
That's usually a big song and dance. We didn't even really, I don't think he even mentioned it. Could have mentioned that. We would have been like, oh, yeah, great. I think, there were some other little bits and pieces I'd really liked, actually. It felt like it's bung something in about tech. Right, let's just do it. And it was just like a real piddly amount for like stuff that's really important.
Driverless and I was like, cars and this stuff. Just robotics, like, 5G network.
A 5G network. I was thinking, there's still people here, but we can't even get a good 3G connection. So good luck with that. But yeah, look, I think that we've covered the main, what you really need to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You seem so excited. Yeah,
it was great, Georgia. I mean, I didn't say it was an hour of my life gone. I promise that wasn't me. No, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Here's 1:42 of your life, which you'll also never get back. It is the highlights of Spreadsheet Phil's comedic display.
This is the spreadsheet bit, but bear with me because I have a reputation to defend.
Come on, Chancellor of the Exchequer.
This will be the last spring budget. The Treasury has helpfully reminded me that I am not the first Chancellor to announce the last spring budget. 24 years ago, Norman Lamont also presented what was billed then as the last spring budget. He reported on an economy that was growing faster than any other in the G7, and he committed to continued restraint in public spending. The then Prime Minister described it as the right budget at the right time from the right Chancellor. What they failed to remind me, Mr. Deputy Speaker, was that 10 weeks later he was sacked. Under the last Labour government, corporation tax was 28%. By the way, they don't call it the last Labour government for nothing. The litany of failed attempts at state control of industry by Labour leave no one in any doubt about that. Except, apparently, the Right Honourable Gentleman opposite, who is now so far down a black hole that even Stephen Hawking has disowned him.
robotic systems and driverless vehicles, a technology I believe the party opposite knows something about. And before they get too excited, Mr. Deputy Speaker, we'll invest in our existing schools too by providing an additional... Oh, yes, we will. By providing an additional £216 million...
Did you like that, Simon?
I probably wouldn't pay to watch him.
No?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah. I mean, I must admit, he raised a smile maybe once or twice from me.
Yeah. You had to wait yourself up for it, though. Yeah. You're listening to This Is Money podcast on Share Radio. We're currently running a short survey to find out what you think of the show, the format, what sort of topics you'd like us to cover. It'll only take you 5 minutes and you could win a brand new Pure DAB radio as our way of saying thank you. Just go to our Twitter or Facebook page for more details.
This Is Money, in partnership with NS&I. Have any premium bond prizes you win paid directly into your bank account.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. With me is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce of This Is Money. Now, we've just spoken about the hit to the pay packet of the self-employed, which will probably make saving for retirement for many even harder. As it is, we're reading this week that most workers, especially in the big cities, are pretty downbeat about whether their pension will be enough for a comfortable old age. Just 36% of us reckon we're on course for a decent retirement. According to former pensions minister and director of policy at Royal London, Steve Webb, says many people are too reliant on minimum contributions.
They're putting in the minimum amount required by law, so is their employer. And that's a fantastic start, but it will only build them a small pension pot. And what we found in our research is if they want the sort of standard of living that most people want, which is, you know, not to see your living standard fall off a cliff when you retire, then if they draw a pension at 65 and cut their hours, they will have to go on working for well over a decade, you know, into their late 70s, before they can actually afford to stop work and enjoy the kind of living standard that they had when they were at work.
Lee, another day, another bad news story that we aren't saving enough for retirement. But I guess this does really throw the issue into sharper relief, given all we've just spoken about in the budget, the squeeze on people's income. It is harder to save money for retirement, I imagine. But what do we actually need? What is this survey showing us?
Well, this survey says that for a comfortable retirement, people think that they need about £21,000, which, you know, is probably not a bad estimate, to be quite frank with you. But you're right, a lot of people, especially, you know, in their 20s, 30s, you know, maybe not 40, maybe 20s and 30s, don't really consider their pension. They don't really think about it. And I don't blame them, to be honest, because it's complicated. It's a complicated area. It's not helped by the fact that things like the light ISA come out and complicate things even further by the fact that this is billed as a retirement product or something you can use to save for a home, which, again, like, you know, we were talking about this last week, and I just don't think that's a sort of right thing. But I mean, look, you have to really start thinking about it. And the earlier you start thinking about it and you start thinking about having a pension, you know, whether it be a private pension or through your employer, the better, you know, because the less you will need to really start putting away each month, you know, the earlier you begin. Or even if you do max it out and put in the maximum contributions and your employer might match it or give it extra, it's really worth thinking these things through, because it could be free money that your employer's basically giving out. All right, you may be having to think it for the long term, and you know, our retirement age seems to be creeping up, like, all the time. I mean, God knows how old we're going to be when we won't retire.
Will
we ever
truth.
retire? And that's the thing, there's a lot of cynical readers that actually genuinely think people of our age possibly won't ever retire. But I think it's important not to, you know, bury your head in the sand about a pension, and, you know, not let the shutters come down as soon as you hear the word pension mentioned. You should just have a look into it. And I really urge anyone, especially, you know, someone even at the beginning of their career, even a couple of years into their career, should be having a look at what they can do to be saving for a better retirement. Because there's lots of people that are now in their 50s, 60s and probably panicking because they don't have a pension, and they think it always had that thought, oh, I'm going to rely on the state pension. I just don't think it's true anymore. I think it's important to have a private pension and really take this thing seriously.
What do you actually need to get to an income of £21,000 a year? What sort of figures are we talking about? I know that's such a hard thing to say, Lee, but, you know,
I need to get that guy with his calculator
from
the weekend from the cafe.
But it's all right, because we've got Simon. He might, you know.
To get to an income of £21,000 a year, you're going to need quite a large sum of money.
Okay, great.
You're going to need about £400,000 to £500,000.
Right.
But that's relying on you just basically spending the spend. That relies on you spending up 4% of it a year. You could probably get away with spending a little bit more than that. But there is an interesting thing here, which is basically the earlier you start, the easier it is.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks to the magic of compounding, which we have referred to, see previous shows.
Most of them, yeah.
This is gains on top of gains that you've already made. So if you save £100 a month for 25 years and you manage to get a return of 6% each year, which is not beyond the realms of possibility from the stock market once you include the dividend yield and any capital growth that you might get over the long term, then you would have £70,000. If you do that for 35 years, an extra 10 years, you will have twice as much money.
Wow.
You will have £140,000. So basically, if you are in your 20s or even in your 30s and you haven't started, start now. And I will give you a personal example of this and how basically just do it, right? When I started my pension at work...
How old were you? Can I ask?
I think it was probably about 27, 28, right? So I had to wait a year after I started at This Is Money, at the company we're at now, because you had to wait a year at that point. And I signed up for it. I put my money in, 5% of my salary, basically, and the company then, you know, matches that. In fact, I'm lucky they more than match it because they were dealing with the getting rid of the old final salary scheme at the time. But basically, at the time when I did that, I didn't really have hardly any money to spare, I didn't think. I was trying to save money to buy a flat and all those other things. All of those concerns that people have, I wasn't paid a particularly large amount of money. But I thought, right, I need to do this because I hadn't done it in my previous job. I was like, I need to start a pension. I need to start doing it. And even at the time, even though it was a relatively small amount of money in monetary terms, it did still feel like, well, that's money coming out of my pocket that I kind of need every month, because at the end of every month, I'm not ending up with any left. But I was like, I need to do this. And I did it. And within a few months, I didn't notice it anymore. Within a year, I certainly didn't notice it. And then if you've got that set amount coming out of your wages, as you progress in your career, your wages will hopefully go up. It starts being more and more and more that goes in. It's still the same 5% of your salary, but you never notice it because you never see that 5% of your salary. That 5% of your salary is taken out before you get any money in your bank account. And it just means that every month there's that money going into your pension, there's that employer's contribution going into your pension, and you stop noticing it. It just becomes something that happens. But it means that the money's going in there. And if you do it when you're in your late 20s or your mid-20s, and you give yourself that jump, it's going to be so much easier than suddenly getting to your mid-40s and going, I haven't saved any money for retirement.
Yeah.
And also, by that point, once you then try and take 5% out of your salary, you're going to notice that quite a lot. Whereas if you just get it coming out immediately, the moment your company says to you or auto-enrolls you in a pension, or your company says to you, you can do this, just do it and just keep doing it forever and a day. And you will, one day, you will sit down and you will thank your lucky stars that you did that.
And you'll think, I remember that Simon Lambert saying to me on this radio show. One thing you probably will notice, Lee, moving on, is your council tax bill could be set to go up by an average of 4% from April. It would be the biggest increase seen for a decade, with the average bill going up to nearly £1,600. What's going on here?
Well, yeah, it's been a big push and lots of noise about social care and how basically councils are struggling to keep up with an ageing population. And a lot of councils, therefore, have decided to raise council tax this year by the maximum amount that they're allowed to, which is 4%. We've had a number of years where council tax bills haven't gone up anywhere near as much as that. It's funny that when there's a run-up to a general election. And basically, yeah, I mean, depending in what band you are, so council tax is obviously done by bands, you could be facing a quite sizable change in your council tax come April.
What happened in Surrey? Weren't they sort of having a vote to see whether they got 15% and then that sort of...
Do you know, this is one of those topics that it sort of whooshed over my hair a little bit, but it's been a bit of a scandal. They were going to have a vote on whether or not 15%, you know, was a better rise for people, because Surrey has quite a wealthy population compared to many other counties. It's also got quite an older population compared to other counties.
So they also pay the most.
Exactly. So there was a whole argument about it. And actually, I thought it was quite interesting to let you know, residents have a say on whether or not they thought they should be paying more council tax. I would have loved
to. You have to. Isn't that the law? That if you go above 4.99%, you actually have to ask the people.
When's that ever happened? I don't know. Simon, you might be able to tell me that. I don't know. But has that ever happened before? I can't remember that happening. So I just think it would have been really interesting because you'd think immediately people go, no way, 15%. Well, no. But actually, interestingly, some of the comments I was seeing were people going, actually, it's probably a bit fair if it goes up 15%. So
I'll be honest with you, Lee. I live in that area and pretty much to a man and woman, everybody said they'd be happy to pay it.
So what I think is interesting here is obviously there's a lot more of a crackdown on how much councils can put up council tax than there used to be back in the day when council tax used to go up by quite an amount. I think that there's an issue here surrounding ring fencing of money. Okay, and governments are notoriously reluctant to ring fence pots of money. They like pots of money to go into the big general pot, right? Mm-hmm. And then they pay for stuff out of it. I think we need to wise up and realise that we need to start ring fencing some money for social care and for the NHS. And then I think maybe we start needing to appeal to people's generosity. I think that we need to say to people, well, would you be willing to pay an extra £50 a month or £25 a month? And that money will go into a social care fund for your local area. And I think that you would find that a lot of people would pay it. If my council said to me, £50 a month extra on your council tax bill, and we promise that it will go into a social care fund for your local area, it will not be spent on other stuff, will you pay it? I would think long and hard about it, and I might consider paying it. And I think that there are a lot of people out there who would pay it. And that means that you're not imposing it on people who can't afford to pay it, but the people who can afford to pay it, like you say, might be willing to do so.
I think they would, Simon. But do you know what the problem is? This is coming full circle about the increase in national insurance. Wasn't that what national insurance was supposed to be about? No one really knows now what it's for. People are very confused by tax, by national insurance. You feel like you're being a bit ripped off. And that makes you less willing to want to help out, surely.
Yeah, it does. And that's the problem with the national insurance. And that's the problem with what Philip Pam said, is he talked about this stuff to do with. And it's still your national insurance contributions are still what racks up your entitlement to a pension. But it's a mistake to think, you know, national insurance is going into this pot that's paying for the NHS and pensions and things like that. National insurance is just another tax. It's basically an extra element of income tax that the government doesn't want to admit exists. And what they should do, and it gets raised by every chancellor, is merge income tax and national insurance. There's a couple of problems with that, which is, at the moment, if you're retired, you don't pay national insurance. Mm. If you've got income from savings and things like that, you don't pay national insurance. So how do you deal with that issue? But Ed Conway wrote a really good article about this today, I think, in The Times, saying, you know, that was the real problem with Hammond's speech. But, you know, my response to that has always been, one day a chancellor will do it, maybe, but who wants to be the chancellor who is remembered for putting up the basic rate of income tax from 20% to 32%, even though that wouldn't mean anybody pays more tax?
Yeah, good luck to that one. Lee, a quick one. It's not just your council tax bill that's set to soar as well, but your insurance bills. Now, in the summer, the cost of a new home, car, medical policies will all rise. It was under plans announced, not this time round, but actually in November by the Chancellor, that insurance premium tax will go up from 10 to 12% in June. It was already been hiked in what you've been calling a £4 billion tax grab, not you personally, but you can expect around £50 to be added to your average policy. But look, that could be a lot higher in some cases to renew your deal. So you've actually created a guide to avoid rip-off cover. What are the things that we can afford to get rid of, the ones that we can't?
There's some things. I mean, insurance is one of those funny things, isn't it? Because, like, what the car industry has argued, for example, the car insurance industry has argued, that this insurance premium tax hike, what it will do is it will drive people to go, do you know what, actually, I'm not going to do the right thing, and I'm not going to get motor insurance because it's really starting to get too expensive. It's going to hit young drivers. It's one of these really sort of like things that's gone under the rug. You know, it's this IPT. People are like, what the hell is IPT? Like, what does it matter to me? But the thing is, it's gone up from 6% to 12% in 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to add £50-100 onto people's policies, you know, from your home insurance to, you know, your pet cover, your car insurance. So, you know, there's lots of things you need to sort of be having a look at. Now, one of the things definitely to do, and I'm a real life example of this. Actually, this time last week, when I came back from the radio show, I went back, I had to do a home insurance renewal. Now, last year when I took out my home insurance, I actually did my buildings and contents separately. That was because when you exchange contracts for a new home, you've got to straight away cover the home. You've got to have buildings insurance. So had a 2-week gap where I had to cover the building, and then 2 weeks later, obviously, we moved in, so then I needed contents. Now, this time round, I got the renewal quote through. Bearing in mind I've not made a claim, you know, I loved the renewal letter. And it's not just this as well, my girlfriend's car insurance, right? We've got renewal letters around about the same time. Both of them, in bold, highlighted that the insurance premium tax had gone up. Almost like this is the reason why your insurance has gone up. So home insurance was going up £150 a year, both of them combined. Car insurance was going up £250 a year. All you got to do is go on a comparison website and say, look, this is what I'm seeing. So anyway, I phoned up the insurer and he said, look, the reason it's going up that much is because your home and your buildings and contents insurance needs to be sort of aligned together. And it kind of does make sense. So that's what he did. I ended up saving something ridiculous on my insurance. I think I'm paying now £80 less than what I was last year. So that is a good tip. I'm sure most people do get their buildings and contents insurance together anyway. Lovely. It was just circumstances last year meant that I didn't have them together. But there's all sorts of little fiddly bits that you can have a look at and make sure that you're not overpaying for. So, for example, if the value of your car, it might have gone down between this year and last year. In fact, it's bound to have gone down more because you've more miles on the clock. So make sure when you come up for your renewal that the price of the car that you've put down has gone down. Make sure you're not overcooking the miles. How many miles do you drive in a year? You know, make sure you're not insuring yourself for more miles than you ever, you know, possibly need. You know, what added drivers have you got in a car? Are people that are added on there ever using the car? Just, I think it's really going to be important this year. This is the year. This is going to sound really boring, and I'm taking my inner spreadsheet Lee here. Right. But you've got to have a look, and you've got to see, make insurance work for you, and make sure that it's all nailed on, because insurance stuff is about to get more expensive. So make sure that you're using comparison websites. Make sure that you are not paying for additional extras you don't need, and save some money.
Absolutely. Why not? And it's not just your insurance as well. And Lee, I want to ask you a bit of a personal question, because we started right at the start, didn't we? Ask about how do we talk with our loved ones about money matters that are quite difficult. And Simon's recently written his will, and he's written an article about it, which he's probably yet to... Have you put it up yet? No. He's going to do it next week, about writing a will. But anything related to that, or the less serious as well, going out for dinner, who should pay the bills? Because actually your colleague, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, has been looking at this. And I do urge you to go onto the website. She's been speaking to family wealth mentor, no less, Diana Chambers. She's got a book out, True Wealth, Letters on Money, Life and Love. How did you broach that conversation with your partner? Are you really open about your finances?
We've opened a joint current account for the first time a couple of weeks ago. So our financial lives are starting to get really intertwined now. And it's we've always been open and honest about our finances, because you have to. If you're in a relationship, if there's no sort of trust in between your finances, then where else isn't there trust, right? And, you know, we bought a home together for the first time last year. That's when everything really does start going under the spotlight. You know, you've got to make sure that, you know, one of you is not overspending on a certain thing or have got something to hide, right? Because you're going through all the credit checks. You're going through these borrowing checks. You don't want to be that person where the bank turns around and goes, do you know what? What's this all about? You know, we don't trust you. So It's a difficult one to broach, and I think it comes over time. You probably start by talking about your salary. You know, I don't think it comes immediately, but you probably do end up start talking about your salary.
Simon, is that one just hit them with your, this is how much I earn?
No,
get your calculator out and just show someone. By the way, everyone,
how do you think I got a girlfriend, Georgie, with my big bumper? This is money wages.
Should laugh too much, Lee. Boss.
I do think that this is an issue for people, especially because people are very private about their finances. But it can be, you know, it can be a serious issue. And it's not just about what you earn. It can be like if you get together with someone and that person's got big debts, then that can become a problem. So you might not know that that person's got a load of money going out in debt every month, or is struggling with debt. And that could be weighing down on them. And that's difficult for people to deal with, you know, from the point of view of the debt. So they should, you know, I think it's very important to be open with your partner about your finances, is my answer to that question.
Well done. Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce.